You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6, it's 1A Plus with a look at a ceasefire in a two-year war in East Africa, plus other news from around the world. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, a new poll from the Washington Post and ABC News finds that nearly 9 in 10 Americans are concerned that political divisions in the U.S. have gotten so bad that politically motivated violence has gotten more likely. That poll was conducted after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's husband was attacked in their San Francisco home last week. Our next guest has studied conflict all around the world and says things don't have to be this way. In fact, she says we know what can help dial down the tension, and we've barely even started doing it here in the U.S. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about political violence maybe tied to next week's election or in the future? Are you discouraged by the divisiveness, the polarization, the negativity in politics? What do you want to see from politicians, from the media, to start bridging some divides? And have you found ways in your own life to disagree with people, but still relate to and talk with them? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Amanda Ripley is a journalist, author, and host of the How To podcast. Her books include High Conflict, How We Get Trapped, and How We Get Out. She recently wrote about preventing political violence in the Washington Post. Amanda, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me. Always good to be with you.
Yeah, good to have you back. Now, I mentioned that one data point, this survey from ABC and the Washington Post, people worried more than they had been previously about political violence. Does that match up with what you're seeing, at least when it comes to perception of a painfully divided country?
Definitely. I think most Americans are exhausted by the political conflict that we're in and worried about the future and rightly worried about violence.
Now, in that recent piece I mentioned, you wrote, "We have not even begun to do the most basic things you would do if you wanted to interrupt this conflict." And this part of this may come as news to people. There are ways. There are strategies. What kind of starting points can we have to try to bridge these gaps that we're not doing right now?
Well, one thing I learned in following people and communities, even countries who have reduced political violence and shifted out of really toxic, dysfunctional conflict, is that any intuitive thing you do is not going to work. So you really have to do counterintuitive things. And so we luckily know a lot about what those things are. And the U.S. government has pushed politicians in many other countries that have been in far worse conflicts to do some basic things that we know dial down the heat a little bit and reduce the odds of political violence. Like, for example, all over the world, the U.S. government has pushed politicians to sign what are sometimes called codes of conduct or non-aggression pacts. And gang violence interrupters do this every day in America. So it's a way to say, hey, we've gotten to a place where there are no rules of engagement anymore. Anything goes. And it's really dangerous because when people feel really threatened, when political leaders keep giving them reasons to feel really threatened, they are much more likely to resort to violence, including people who are, you know, mentally unstable or in pain for other reasons. But that language really matters. And so one of the things that you would do is to say, hey, get a bunch of influential politicians from all sides into a room. What are some things that we would like to change about how we're treating each other? Maybe it's to not dehumanize your opponent on social media by saying they're evil or hate America, right? Or maybe it's to vow to accept the results of an election after reasonable due process. Almost always you commit to condemning acts of violence, especially when they're perpetrated against the other side. So these are just basic things that we ask other countries to do, even when they're emerging from civil war. And so that would be one thing we would want to ask our own politicians to do.
We're talking to Amanda Ripley, author of the book High Conflict, about techniques, proven ways in many countries around the world to dial down political conflict, how they could apply here in the U.S. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Amanda, people might hear the idea of, okay, let's get Democrats and Republicans, say, to sit down and come together on these ground rules. And it sounds maybe a little naive and something you can't imagine politicians doing. But You reference this ad here from the candidates for governor in Utah 2 years ago. We got a Republican and a Democrat here. I want to give a listen.
We are both equally dedicated to the American values of democracy, liberty, and justice for all people.
We just have different opinions on how to achieve those ideals.
But today, we are setting aside those differences to deliver a message that is critical for the health of our nation.
That whether you vote by mail or in person, we will fully support the results of the upcoming presidential election, regardless of the outcome.
Although we sit on different sides of the aisle, we are both committed to American civility and a peaceful transition of power.
I mean, that's pretty cool, but it's really unique. I don't see a lot of other stuff like this. Do we need more of this kind of thing?
Yeah. And, you know, that ad ended up going viral and gave both candidates an unexpected boost. And then, we do know there's a yearning for it among voters, even though we think there's not, there is. And researchers recently tested the ad and found in a huge sample of 32,000 people and found that it significantly reduced support for partisan violence. So we need more of these to answer your question, Rob. And, you know, to this question of, well, isn't this naive? How could you ever get some of these political leaders, especially the most influential ones, to the table? I had the same objection, right? It seems just Pollyanna. And so I brought that same question. This is the only thing I know how to do, is to ask other people who know more than I do. And so I brought it to Curtis Toler, who does gang violence interruption in Chicago. And I brought it to Neilan Parker, who works for Search for Common Ground USA and has worked in conflict zones all over the world. And they both said, Amanda, it always feels impossible. But here's the thing. All these people, even the ones who are really benefiting from the conflict, you know, they're raising money off of it, they're getting power and attention, votes, right? Even those people, most of them, not all, but most of them do not want to get hurt or for their family to get hurt. And that's the argument. That's the sales pitch you use with gang leaders, with guerrilla members in other countries in civil war. It's the same argument because no one wants to die, right? And most people, what Curtis has found in gang violence interruption, most people would like to get out of the conflict or at least have it change and be less toxic. But no one has asked them. No one has invited them. So you have to be smart about it. You have to be strategic about how you do this. But the idea that none of these people will come to the table just isn't supported by history or the evidence.
Now, I want to spend most of our time on things that do work. But you mentioned earlier that in a conflict situation, a high conflict situation in particular, there might be intuitive things that seem obvious, and you said a lot of those don't work. Can you give us an example of something that, you know, at the gut level sounds like the way to resolve this conflict that doesn't?
Right. Well, you know, vowing to destroy the other side in the next election would be one example, right? Or to impeach the president, right? Like, these are all worthwhile endeavors, and it's important to hold people accountable, but it doesn't tend to interrupt high conflict, because high conflict operates really differently from normal conflict. It's the kind of thing where people are so dug in that they make a lot of mistakes. And so everything feels like a threat, including things that aren't threatening. So, you know, in a smaller conflict, it might be, you know, if I can just argue the facts with my relative who disagrees with me, if I can just, you know, crush them with statistics and controlled research studies, that they will change their mind. Again, doesn't work. That just is not how people, unfortunately, not how people work, especially in this kind of conflict where it's much more emotional. It's much more about belonging, about humiliation, about a fear of our kids not belonging in the future. So if we're not speaking to those things, then it's not going to work.
We're talking to journalist Amanda Ripley, author of the book High Conflict, looking at the fear of violence in an election year and more generally the political divide the increasingly conflictual political divide it feels like in the United States, how to keep in perspective and start improving our political rhetoric and the way we talk to and about each other. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this, that ad you just heard? Would you want to see Tony Evers and Tim Michaels do an ad like that? Mandela Barnes and Ron Johnson? Do you want to see less divisive language from politicians across the board? Are you worried about these conflicts? Have you found ways to bridge gaps, maybe in your own household, your own family, your community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with journalist and author Amanda Ripley about political divisions in this election year, the threat of political violence, and the tools that are out there that can help us move out of deeply rooted conflicts. Things that have worked after civil wars around the world, dealing with gang violence, and that could maybe help the American political system. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Edward is with us in Milwaukee. Edward, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. The first observation I've got is, you know, to compare political opponents to gangs is, you know, it does seem outrageous, and yet I think your guest has great ideas. It just seems to me that nobody is held to account, to be accountable for what they do anymore, and it's really frustrating for me as a you know, as an American citizen. And I would love to be part of a movement that would achieve this. And thank you, guest, for coming on.
Edward, thanks for that call. Let's start with that last thing he said first, Amanda. He would love to become part of a movement to achieve some of the things you are talking about. Is there such a movement? How could somebody like Edward get involved?
You know, I think that movement is underway, and it gives me heart. It gives me strength to hear Edward say that. I think it's going to take a bunch of different forms. It's not going to be one unified, website we can all sign on to, but some of the ones that I feel like are doing some creative work in this space would be Starts With Us, which is an organization that is trying to kickstart that movement. Also, Braver Angels has done a lot of work in helping us rehumanize each other and understand each other, even as we continue to disagree. And there are lots of others, but you're not alone. I can tell you that much, Edward, for sure.
Thanks for the call, Edward. Edward also talks about a lack of consequences as he sees it, where, and I think we've seen some of this, okay, this norm gets violated, and we look around, and it doesn't seem to be a big consequence of it, so maybe it gets pushed a little further and a little further. How do we stop that? Who holds someone accountable if someone on one side is doing that sort of thing?
Yeah, there's sometimes a game that a trap I fall into in my own head. I don't know if this is familiar to your listeners, but where something really insane will happen, and I'll think automatically in my head, I'll think, oh, this will be the thing. This will be the thing that convinces everybody that this has gone too far, right? Or that this person needs to be held accountable. And then I've learned enough about this kind of conflict to understand that, unfortunately, that's pretty much never true, but that's just not the way humans behave in an us versus them malignant conflict like that, because we get so dug in and so threatened by the other side that we will rationalize and justify almost anything, mostly out of fear of the alternative, you know? So that doesn't mean that people can't be reached. I mean, most Americans are not on the extremes of this particular conflict, but it does mean that the conflict doesn't operate according to the ways healthy conflict operates, where people do get held accountable by voters, if nothing else.
Let's go to Samuel now in Neenah. Samuel, hi.
Hi, you hear me?
Loud and clear, Samuel. Go ahead.
Great. So my question is to the guest, is what are the situations and scenarios socially that we might find ourselves in where we might talk to somebody from the other side in that situation where they're open to hearing ideas that they don't necessarily agree with, that the conversation doesn't devolve into hostility immediately, or the conversation is avoided completely because the scenario is not right. Like, what are those situations when it's okay to talk about this and it's actually maybe useful if it's approached the right way?
Samuel, that's a fantastic question. And Amanda, I'll say at listener events, I've heard versions of that question from other people, even talking about, you know, their own family members and things like that. What advice do you have about having those kind of conversations?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of advice out there, and I find it mostly kind of unhelpful because it feels really pat and kind of one-dimensional. And in fact, this is really hard, and it requires practice and care and a very different mindset. So I'm really excited because recently I was able to do a podcast. I host this podcast called How To, and we were able to actually coach two adult siblings who wanted to change how they debate politics with their father, coach them with an expert who does this from Braver Angels, the organization I just mentioned. Her name is Monica Guzman. And then with their dad's permission, they recorded the long conversation they then had, which you usually don't get to hear. So my bottom line is, to understand this, to do it better, we need to see and hear more examples of it over and over and over. Because part of how we've gotten into this mess is by seeing and hearing examples of the opposite, right? Often led by, you know, cable TV news or national politicians. So for me, it's really, really helpful to hear examples of what this looks like. And a lot of it is giving up on agreeing and getting really, really interested in understanding. Because most people, they need to feel heard before they will listen. And there are some really good tips and tricks for making that happen. So it's an excellent question that I think most people are really struggling with, and we need to get more skilled about how we argue about politics and, you know, everything else.
If you want to hear an example of that, we're going to get a link to the How To podcast at WPR.org/Central Time. That'll be in the segment note for this conversation with Amanda Ripley, author of the book High Conflict, looking at ways to dial down political tensions here in the United States. How can we find situations to have more conversations like this, Amanda? As you mentioned, it's not that easy if two people from one side just get together and talk without any kind of guidance. There's a good chance it's not going to go well.
Right. So I definitely don't recommend just plunging in. You know, I think that's not a good idea. And again, gets back to that big takeaway, which is like any intuitive thing you do in high conflict to get out of the conflict will almost certainly make it worse. So what does that mean? Well, Braver Angels has a bunch of resources for this, and actual workshops and debates that you can go to practice these skills. There's also something called Living Room Conversations. Livingroomconversations.org is the address. And they have a bunch of guides for actually, you know, intentionally, purposefully creating gatherings, either virtually or in person, with conversation guides and some like guardrails in place so that those conversations will go better. So those are two places to look into.
I want to ask you about, and we've talked about this in the past, in any conflict, there are often people who perceive, hey, I benefit from this conflict, or I benefit, or my side benefits from this conflict escalating. Conflict entrepreneurs, you call them. How do we try to remove their power in these conflicts?
You know, I think conflict entrepreneurs, I mean, first of all, we can all be conflict entrepreneurs, especially in a climate like this, especially when we've developed a bunch of social media platforms to incentivize conflict entrepreneurs. But yeah, I mean, people who inflame and sort of incite conflict for their own ends, whether it's profit or, you know, just as often it's for attention or a sense of belonging or being important, all those things are really, really powerful right now. So it's something we can all have to sort of be careful about. The first thing is to notice who are the conflict entrepreneurs in your orbit, whether it's in your social media feed or in your news feed most often, and maybe consider literally turning down the volume, like distancing yourself, because people who make a career out of, you know, really exploiting conflict tend to have a lot of damage in their own past that they either haven't been able or willing to deal with yet. And hopefully they will one day, but typically they tend to just spread that pain around over time. So, you know, just for your own peace of mind, it's important to recognize who conflict entrepreneurs are at any given time. Try not to be one, and then try to distance yourself from them. And I think we in the news media have to get much better at turning down the volume on conflict entrepreneurs, of recognizing that continuing to amplify this isn't helping in the way we think it will. You know, we think, oh, if we could just draw attention to these outrageous things that people are saying, they will stop. And to Edward's point, your caller earlier, that's not how this works.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Amanda, things might look a little dark now. Do you feel, and I think I ask you this every time, do you feel some optimism at this point?
And what do I say every time? Every time I say yes. And I think, look, I don't, you know, optimism might be strong. I do feel hope. Sometimes things do have to get worse before they get better. I suspect that is true here, unfortunately, just people being people. And because we've not tried many of these things, I do feel some, ironically, some hope. Because if we just did a bunch of basic things, this would get better. And so that gives me hope.
Amanda, we'll leave it there. Always good to talk to you.
Thanks so much for having me. Take care.
That's Amanda Ripley, journalist and author. Her books include High Conflict, How We Get Trapped and How We Get Out. We talked to her about dialing down political tensions as next week's election approaches and what to do about it. You can find her recent article on that link to WPR.org/Central Time, plus her how-to podcast with an example of a guided conversation between two people who disagree with each other that doesn't, I guess, I haven't listened myself, doesn't end in tears and bitterness. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, a new partnership between police agencies and the Veterans Administration aims to boost gun safes and gun safety. A police chief joins the show to share the details. Plus, from wound treatment to scurvy prevention, we'll look at a new book about attempted medicinal uses of alcohol. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, a look at how people cast their ballots in the 2020 elections and how they're casting them now during the current midterms. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's Food Friday, and our guest has lots of pasta advice. She'll walk us through how to make our own homemade pasta, plus pasta sauces and great recipes with pasta, whether it's homemade or store-bought. First, most voters in 2020, about 64% of them, voted early in person or by mail instead of in person on Election Day. That's according to numbers from the Federal Election Commission. And there's a lot of interest in early voting in the 2022 midterms. Early turnout has been high. Over 5.5 million people have already voted in person or by mail. But the future of these early voting techniques is unclear. After the 2020 election, 18 states, most with Republican-controlled legislatures, added some restrictions on earlier voting. 22 states expanded it. Some other states were mixed bags. We're talking now about how people choose to vote, what mail-in and early voting looks like after changes following the 2020 election, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. How did you vote in the 2020 election? Not who did you vote for, but how did you cast your ballot? Was it a one-off? You did it differently, maybe because it was peak COVID? Or do you like the option of voting by mail or voting in person early? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Oh, yeah. How are you voting this year? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Paul Hernson is a professor of political science at the University of Connecticut. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. I have to tell you, I listened to Wisconsin Public Radio while I was a grad student in the political science department at UW, and I'm just tickled pink to be on your show.
Well, welcome back to Wisconsin. Good to have you with us then.
Thank you.
Let's go back to 2020. We had a lot of states had some form of earlier voting options in place. And because of COVID, a lot more people took them up on it. Can you talk about what we saw in fall of 2020?
Yeah, it's the way things work here is under the U.S. Constitution, states have broad authority to administer elections. And as a result of COVID, quite a bit did. But first, let's talk about the variation. So there's absentee mail with an excuse, age, disability, you're going to be out of town, you have to meet a pre-existing excuse. There's no excuse absentee mail ballots where you just ask for it. There's universal mail voting where if you're a registered voter, it comes in the mail. And as you said, there's early in-person voting. And of course, Election Day always works. So, you know, the states made some decisions to respond, and those decisions gave voters options and their habits, their prior experiences, or their familiarity, let's say, and their partisanship structured their choices. So pre-pandemic, 30 states had no excuse absentee mail options, including Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. 16 said, you can have a mail ballot, but you need to have an excuse. And that actually includes where I live right now, Connecticut. And 5 had this universal mail elections where you, if you're registered to vote, you automatically get a ballot. And roughly 40 plus had early in-person voting. The pandemic certainly scared a lot of people, rightfully so. And 16 states changed what they were doing. 36 said you can get an absentee or a mail ballot without an excuse, or you can call fears of COVID a reasonable excuse. 5 kept restrictive excuse requirements, and 10 offered universal mail elections. 5 of those previously were no excuse voting states, and a few more added early in-person voting. So with those options in place, voters were able to make some decisions about how to vote for the first time. I guess before we jump into that, I would say that, you know, there weren't that many states that changed because quite a few had a safe, convenient voting option. Mm-hmm. But among those that did, states with a Democratic governor or democratically controlled statehouse were more likely to make it easier, more convenient, safer to vote than those controlled by the Republican Party, and the states with divided control were in the middle.
Right. I want to get into another question here before we bring on some callers at 800-642-1234. As you mentioned, a lot of people took advantage of some opportunity to do something other than show up at the polls on Election Day. The big question now is, are people going to keep doing that, having had that experience? So in states where people have an option of voting on Election Day or doing something else, what are you watching for to see if those habits persist?
Well, you know, you put your finger right on it. Habits are important. So what we know is people who are familiar with something are more likely to use it than people who are introduced to it for the first time. So in 2020, you know, lazy expectations for 2022. So voters in the states that kept a policy where you could, you know, ask for an absentee ballot, you know, to come to you in the mail, and you didn't have to have an excuse, among those voters were 22 percentage points more likely to vote by mail than voters who were given the option for the first time. So that shows you familiarity is really important. And of course, those voters who were familiar with voting by mail, no excuse absentee voted, were 27 points more likely to vote by mail than those in states where you had to have an excuse. So the expectation would be that people who are familiar with it because they used it prior to 2020 or in 2022 or prior to 2020 or during 2020 will be more likely to vote with a mail ballot. Of course, partisanship is important. You know, how you voted really wasn't a very partisan issue prior to 2020, but it did become very important then. And Democrats were 13 percentage points more likely than incumbents to vote by mail, and a whopping 26 points more likely than Republicans. So we would expect that some of this partisan difference will persist, especially because of all the claims of election fraud and the denying the outcome of the election.
Let's bring on a caller now. Lisa is with us in Madison. Lisa, hi.
Hi, I did vote absentee, and part of the main reason I did that is I'm a poll worker, and I will not be working at the location that I vote at, and I am working the polls from 6 in the morning until close.
Whoa.
So without absentee, I wouldn't be able to vote.
Well, great reason to vote, Lisa. Thanks for doing that. That's a long shift. Have you done that before?
Yeah, I have. You know, it gets to be a long day, but it's worth it, and I'm happy I can do it.
Lisa, thanks for doing that important work, and thanks for sharing that story. Paul, Lisa, she doesn't need an excuse to get an absentee ballot in Wisconsin, but that sounds like a pretty good one.
Yeah, Wisconsin's pretty good about that, and it is a good reason, and I'm familiar with other people that do that as well.
Lisa, thanks for that call. We're talking to University of Connecticut political science professor Paul Hernson about the way people voted in 2020, early voting options, mail voting options versus in-person, and how we're voting in the current midterms. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on mail-in voting? Do you prefer it? Did you vote early in person or by mail, maybe for the first time in 2020? Are you doing a repeat performance next week? Or have you already done it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up the conversation about how people choose to cast their ballots with University of Connecticut political science professor Paul Hernson. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you vote? How do you like to vote? Do you think there needs to be a change to make things easier or add more regulations? Either way, call in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Mark is with us in Door County. Mark, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks a lot for taking my call. I'm up here in Ellison Bay, so way up in the northern tip of Door County, and it's a very polarized place as far as I can tell from a political point of view. It's kind of like there's a ton of signs and they're sort of half and half in the Door County. So it's a very kind of diverse place. I voted absentee, no questions asked absentee. I got used to doing that because I lived in Utah. Utah is a very Republican state, and all your voting is by mail in Utah, and everything seems to work great. So I voted no questions absentee in this general election. I voted in person in the primary. I thought everything went great. I'll be really disappointed if they get rid of no questions asked absentee voting in Wisconsin.
Mark, thanks for the call. Paul, have we seen any states moving away from no questions asked, no excuse needed absentee voting?
You know, there's been some move to make it more difficult to shorten the window to apply for a ballot. Where I live in Connecticut, we have pretty restrictive voting laws. There's no early in-person voting. And prior to the pandemic, there was no opportunity to get a mail ballot. During the pandemic, under an emergency order, we were able to get it there. You could mail it back or put it in a drop box. And they extended that emergency order through 2022. However, once 2024 rolls around, we will not have that no excuse absentee mail ballot option unless there's a big change. In Connecticut, it's very difficult to make that change.
Interesting. Thanks for that call. Now, I often think of Connecticut as a more blue state. Utah is a more red state. But here we have you say Connecticut is more restrictive. Utah makes it pretty easy to vote by mail. It doesn't always go the partisan way we might expect.
That is true. It certainly doesn't. There are other issues. Sometimes race comes into consideration. Seniority comes into consideration. Election administrators often want to try to cater to the needs of their constituents. It's not always so easy, though. When you think about fixing an election, sometimes you fix it to address a problem like a pandemic, and you make it, you know, and people and policymakers put in options that make it easier and safer to vote. And that's wonderful. And other times politicians put the fix in a way that favors certain candidates, certain parties, maybe certain factions in parties. So there's always these two words or ways of interpreting the word fix when it comes to fixing elections, and partisan advantage is one of the things, but also meeting voters' concerns and needs is another.
Thanks again for that call. Sherilyn joins us now in Delavan. Sherilyn, hi.
Hey, how are y'all doing?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call. So I've always either voted on election day or voted early in person. This was my first year because I thought I might have a conflict that I requested an absentee ballot. And I can just tell you the stress that I went through filling out the ballot and then, you know, checking to see is every I dotted, every T crossed, and then I have to have an adult, which was my husband, that make sure the ballot was blank when I got it and that I filled it in with nobody helping me. It just made me feel like a child and like I couldn't do anything right. And it was just a very demeaning exercise.
Interesting, Sherilyn. Thanks for sharing that. Actually, Sherilyn, are you going to do it again or are you going to go back to in person?
No. And I did drop the ballot off in person. I didn't stick it in the mail. Mm-hmm. I dropped it off in person at the county clerk because the whole process just made me worry that my vote wasn't going to be counted.
Sherilyn, thanks for the call. And Paul, there are some nitpicky points here. If your witness doesn't fill in their complete address, including zip code, there are concerns that could be challenged. Sherilyn found this a stressful experience for some of those reasons.
Well, that's not unusual. It can be more stressful and also there are more likely to be errors committed. And it's not like you can say, I messed up my ballot. Can I have another one, please? In terms of dropping it off, that's another very interesting point. Many people where I live in Connecticut requested a mail ballot, and many of us dropped it off and put it into one of those, big metal drop boxes. And that boosted our confidence. Interestingly enough, a few places are getting rid of those drop boxes.
Including Wisconsin under a court order. Right. We had them for some years. Rural communities especially were using drop boxes. Now under a court ruling, they've said no, according to state law, that shouldn't be a thing anywhere. Are we seeing other, is Wisconsin alone in that? Or you're saying other states are dropping drop boxes?
Yes. Well, Texas law recently banned them and New Hampshire eliminated them after its governor terminated an emergency order that was in place during the pandemic. So a few other states have taken that position, that direction.
Time for one more caller. Jay is with us in Two Rivers. Jay, hi.
Yes, good afternoon. Well, I've been voting for about 50 years, the last 40 as an independent. And I think that voting should be as easy as possible in every form, mail-in, absentee. And it's quite distressing that in the last 12 years or so, one party has made it their mission to reverse everything that's worked well for beyond 50 years.
Jay, thanks for the call. And Jay, talking about efforts to tighten up some of those easier election voting methods, citing security reasons often. Could you talk about Jay's concerns, Paul?
Well, I think his concerns are real. When the goal of making it easier to vote is to broaden access to broaden access and just to make it more convenient so people don't have to take off from work so they can do it when it works for them. To be frank, Democrats have been somewhat more likely to push that kind of reform than Republicans, but not by all that much. What happened was, we are in a very competitive situation with elections and control of government. And the issue was politicized in 2020. And for better or worse, now people are thinking, wow, every vote's going to count in this Senate race or this House race or the presidential race. And it might work to our advantage to make it difficult for certain population groups to vote because they support the opposite party. Adding all the election denier arguments and politicizing how we vote was just it's a terrible thing. And it's ironic, too, because prior to 2020, when we looked at people who used a convenience voting methods, Republicans tended to favor mail a little bit more than Democrats, and Democrats tended to favor voting early in person more than Republicans. But since 2020, voting by mail ballots have just become attacked, and I think unreasonably so.
Paul, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Paul Hernson is a professor of political science at the University of Connecticut. He talked to us today about how people are voting in the midterms. not who they're voting for, but how physically they're casting their ballots. After many states passed new laws about mail-in voting and early voting following the 2020 election. For an election taking place this year, the candidates for governor have spent a lot of time talking about the race for president 2 years from now. And there's a good reason for that. As Sean Johnson reports, whoever gets elected could have a huge say in setting the rules for Wisconsin elections for years to come.
Less than 2 weeks before Election Day, former President Barack Obama visited a packed high school gymnasium in Milwaukee to deliver closing arguments for Wisconsin Democrats. He had the crowd roaring as he talked about abortion rights, protecting Social Security, and helping people pay their bills. And then Obama turned to an issue that's not at the top of every voter's mind.
If you do need another reason to vote, consider the fact that democracy is also on the ballot.
Obama spoke at length about democracy, about how life had changed since the January 6th insurrection, and about how it would be dangerous if self-governance is lost. For Democrats, the warnings are a way to mobilize voters who might stay home in a midterm election. Republicans have used a similar approach when they talk about election integrity. Underpinning all of this talk is a hard reality. If Republican Tim Michaels defeats Democratic Governor Tony Evers, Republicans will change the way elections are run in a state that's as politically divided as they come. Barry Burden directs the Elections Research Center at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
There could likely be big changes to election law in Wisconsin between 2022 and 2024.
For example, Michaels wants to eliminate the bipartisan Wisconsin Elections Commission, which is currently run by an appointed board split 3-3 between Republicans and Democrats. He says the new agency will be different.
I'm going to call it the Wisconsin Election Integrity Group. It'll have representation from all 8 congressional districts.
But Michaels hasn't said who will choose those members. Burden says there would be nothing keeping Michaels and the legislature from running the agency with only Republican appointees.
Yeah, there are really no limits on what the legislature could do in terms of creating a new structure. It might be a board that's entirely partisan.
Democratic Elections Commissioner Ann Jacobs says she has a different concern. Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson has floated the idea of having lawmakers oversee federal elections, which is known as the independent state legislature theory.
So that is a profound threat to democracy across the entire United States and including in Wisconsin.
A case arguing this theory is pending before the U.S. Supreme Court. There's another open question when it comes to regulating absentee voting. Last year, Republicans hired former Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman to investigate the 2020 election. In March, he issued a report calling for minimizing absentee voting. Gableman has since been fired, but he still holds considerable sway in the Republican Party. At a rally for Michaels in August, former President Donald Trump pointed out Gableman in the crowd multiple times, just to say thank you.
Justice Michael Gableman, for the job that you've done and the incredible strength that you've shown.
Rick Essenberg, the president of the conservative Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, notes that people used to need a reason to vote absentee in Wisconsin. Now, voters don't need an excuse, and the practice is popular.
But I don't see that changing. I think, you know, voter convenience is probably going to win out with these elected officials.
But Republicans have promised to restrict absentee voting in smaller ways, including by limiting who can say they're indefinitely confined when it comes to voting. There's no need to guess about these proposals. GOP lawmakers passed almost 20 of them already. Evers vetoed the bills, and Michaels says he'd sign them. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We're talking about how to make our own pasta and pasta sauces from scratch, plus some recipes, whether you buy the pasta at a store or make your own at home. You can find a few recipes. Start cooking right now over at WPR.org/Food Friday. And hey, if you make your own pasta regularly, or if you've tried and failed, or if you're too scared, like me, want to hear about it right now, you can email ideas@WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.